Hello and welcome to Series 3 of Tell Dem, a podcast hosted by The Masher in partnership with Transmission Roundhouse, generously funded by the Paul Hamlin Foundation.
This series, we're shifting things around a bit, bringing you bold and unfiltered discussions around decolonising theatre.
Every episode, we'll be joined by amazing theatre makers from the global majority, discussing power structures, global influences,
what they do, how they do it, why they do it.
We're your hosts, Gidiga
and Beth, and you are tuning into episode one.
This podcast contains themes that listeners may find disturbing, triggering, or uncomfortable. Welcome to episode one. How exciting.
Really excited. And my name is Beth Capilla.
And my name is Githy Gabatu.
And we are the regional associates at The Masher. And we're going to be telling you a little bit more about that, a bit about our work, what we've been doing since we started back in 2023. And then we're going to get into some deep dives.
Yeah, we're kicking off with some fantastic guests. So who have we got lined up today, Beth?
So today we have with us Pooja Guy, the artistic director for The Masher. And we have Dermot Daly, a brilliant sort of interdisciplinary artist across like all media that I can think of.
We're going to be talking all things decolonizing, dismantling, and also thinking about the provocation, do global majority artists have spaces to dream?
A really, really interesting place to kick off the series.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we talk a little bit about what our roles are as regional associates at The Masher and what we've been doing since we both started at the same time together?
Yeah, Beth and I were brought on about 10 months ago to really focus on dismantling structures that currently exist within the UK theatre industry that feel very much entrenched in colonialism and still inherently racist, that hinder global majority artists and audiences from accessing them.
And I think it's safe to say when we both started, it felt huge. It feels huge because there's a lot of people that it means a huge amount to, and there's a lot of people that are affected by it, and so it's a big responsibility to
sure, and such an exciting opportunity as well. Like, when do we ever get time afforded as artists to really sit and have space and time to think? And that's something that Pooja and the rest of the team at The Masher really gave us that time and sort of said, just sit with it and sit in it. And actually, immediately, what was really interesting is both of our reactions as freelancers was to be like, OK, let's come up with a plan. Let's do something. Let's get it out. Let's action it. Let's send it out to theatres.
Yeah, I think that's really important. We started with artists and theatre makers asking, what are the barriers? And making sure that we weren't making assumptions based on our own personal experiences, because we're both theatre directors and didn't want to be speaking on the behalf of an entire industry of people. And so artists were where we started, and we gained so much from that.
We're here. So we're going to kick off with Dermot Daly. So Dermot is an actor, writer, director and producer who's worked across radio, television, film and theatre. Originally hailing from Birmingham and now living in Leeds. Whoop, whoop, my hometown. Big up. He has been the associate artistic director of Freedom Studios and is an associate faculty member of the New York Institute of Dance and Education, as well as current faculty at Leeds Conservatoire and Leeds Beckett. For stage, you could recently find Dermot working on Bruntwood Playwriting Prize winning Bullring Techno Makeout Jams at the Edinburgh Fringe and Royal Court Theatre as well. And there might be some exciting news that Dermot might share at the end of the podcast regarding that little chestnut.
We have with us today Pooja Guy, who is a theatre director and the artistic director and joint CEO for The Masher Theatre Company. She is the co-chair for Stage Directors UK and was also co-chair for Artistic Directors of the Future. Pooja's known for championing real and lasting change in our sector for makers from the global majority. Part of this work, she also sits on the panel for Lit in Colour Fest, advocating to put texts created by writers from the global majority onto the national curriculum, which is pretty cool. So, yeah, thank you so much for joining us today for episode one.
Lovely. And we're going to start with a question that we're actually going to ask all the artists who are joining us on this podcast series in each episode. And that question is, what inspired you this week? So who am I going to hand over to? Looks like it's going to be Pooja.
What a great question. Well, this week, what inspired me? I spent my Easter weekend in Manchester with my very dear friend, Rani Murthy, and we were there celebrating the life of her late husband, Arthur. And across her dining table for 2 days were four generations of women. Four women from different areas of discipline within the sector, from different parts of the world, sitting around a table talking about life, love, art and politics. It really was one of the most nourishing moments that I've had in a long time. And actually, me being the youngest of all of that lived experience, I kind of felt like it was such an amazing gift. We had a gorgeous Sri Lankan lamb curry. We had Indo-Chinese chicken. Rani made a mascarpone trifle. And it was that thing of breaking bread around the table and sharing and talking. Which is something I think we need to inject full flow into our sector and our communities, actually. Mm. Breaking bread Absolutely. Together and chatting.
Like it. Love it. What's inspired me this week? I think a couple of things, but maybe two things that are kind of interconnected. One's very odd. My car isn't working. It's got this weird thing whereby when it's stationary or even when I'm driving, the boot decides to open itself. With no injection from me, so my car loses its mind and beeps at me, so I have to pull over and shut the boot. But one of the things that I'm really minded of is it's made me really mindful of what's happening. Every time I now get into the car, I need to remember that I need to lock myself in the car. And I think that level of mindfulness, just taking a second of going, where am I? Why am I here? What is happening? But all of that emanating from that, I found really useful. And then the thing that's linked to that is to look at Ryan Cameron and Dan Bailey, and both of them having shows on in the West End at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, Red Pitch and For Black Boys being on in town at the same time kind of blows my mind a little bit, because that would never have happened when I was 15. That would never have happened 5, 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And to have two shows that contain the casts and the people that are in it and the thoughts that are in it and the ideas that are in it and the language and the vibrancy that all of that brings to the West End, when not very long ago it was rumoured that if you had a black or an Asian lead, then the show wouldn't sell. Mm-hmm. And there are two shows proving that that is not true. Just taking a bit of a mindful moment to step back and go, this is where we are. And there's lots of things that are wrong. Or lots of things that we could change about the industry, we could change about our society. Often we focus on the things that aren't working as opposed to the things that are working. And this is all emanated from my boot not working.
This
is how my brain works. Welcome to my life.
The analogy, that's great.
Yeah, and also celebrating the wins, like you said, is so important. There's so much to do, right? But it's also, we have to stop and celebrate the wins and take that space. It's just as important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful. How about you, Githika?
Oh, God.
What's inspired you this week?
What has inspired me? So many things. I'm going to... Do you know what? Mine's actually about eating. It's a really small one, but I met a mate of mine who came up from Birmingham, and we went to eat in Manchester. And we went to a place called Mackie Mayer's. I don't know if anyone has
ever been. Oh, it's incredible.
Oh, my God, it's insane. And for anyone that doesn't know, in fact, I'm literally feel like I'm, promoting or influencing Mackie Mayer's. Shout out to Mackie Mayer's. You basically go and it's like a food hall. It's not that revolutionary, but you can go around. It's that thing where you can go and eat anywhere. So I can sit with you, you can have tacos, you can have a curry, whatever. It doesn't really matter. But the thing that's gorgeous about it is the setup where you dine is you dine on long tables together, and there's no like tables for two, really. There's no tables for before you all just eat together and you have to just sit with people. And there was just something really gorgeous about sitting together and chatting with a bunch of people that you wouldn't normally, and that sense of community, which I just think more often, especially nowadays, like it's just stripped from society. And I think it just makes me feel lonely anyway sometimes. Oh my God, I don't mean to get sad, but like it does. And I think, you know, it's important to recognise those moments of community. So that's what inspired me. I'm going to pass it over to you.
So I went to see Nye at the National Theatre the weekend with my family, and inspired on like different levels. Like one, the idea that the rights that we have and the privilege of having something like the NHS, but just more broadly in society, the things that we've won through fighting, you can never sit back and think, well, I've fought once and we've got this. We can now just relax. Like, we have to constantly keep fighting. And secondly, Nye Bevan was from Tredegar, and part of my mum was born in Tredegar, like literally over the mountain, and it's sort of a part of my heritage that I've not really like fully connected with. I've connected more with sort of the Indian side of my heritage and the English side of my heritage, but the Welsh side, not really connected with. And like, we got home and my mum called me and was like, yeah, my granddad used to meet Nye on the top of a mountain, like for walks with his wife, and like just finding out these stories about like, yeah, that this part of my family that I've not really connected to. And now I want to delve deeper.
How wonderful.
Well, let's do exactly that. Let's do some delving deeper. That's a really nice segue to our first provocation, if you like. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to say the thing, I'm going to plop it on the table, and then I'm going to go really quiet, and then someone's going to say something. So
that's the hope, at least, right?
That's the hope. We can just sit here in silence also. That's fine. We could be mindful, couldn't we, for 45 minutes.
Let the audience fill in the gaps.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Okay, here we go. Decolonize and dismantle. What does that mean to you?
Oh, wow. Stuff. I could be really facetious, and say it means everything and nothing. I guess that's the facetious way of looking at it. I think the thoughtful way of looking at it is, to understand what decolonization is, you have to understand what colonization is. If the prefix D is to remove, so understanding what it is that needs removing is important. And I don't know, it depends on the environment, and it depends on how we're looking at the word decolonize. I'm going to stick with that for a minute as opposed to dismantle. Because, you know, if you're thinking about it in terms of Frantz Fanon and that kind of decolonization of states, then that is something for a bigger mind than mine to understand and get my head around. Because any way that I would look at it would be from, you know, a kind of pre-GCSE history level of generality. To decolonize is to remove the colonizers. Brilliant, cool. I tend to think of decolonization of Wathiango's written a book about, I think it's called Decolonize the Mind, and it talks very much about how colonization works. And he, as a writer, and me as someone who tells stories, hone in on the idea of words and what they can and can't give. And he hones in very cogently, I think, very clearly on the first thing that the colonizer does is to change or remove your language. It's something that George Orwell talked about in 1984. And before we start, George Orwell is a deeply problematic character, person, as is Wathiango, to be fair. You know, this sits within a brilliant dramaturg, Suze Bellett at the Royal Exchange, said to me years ago in a group session that when we're thinking about characters and people, we're not either or, we're both and. And I think holding that in tandem as well, is what, you know, in terms of thinking about decolonization, it is both and. It's not either or.
So do you mean we're both decolonized or colonizing and decolonizing?
Colonizer and colonized.
Colonizer and colonized. Is that what, yeah?
That is exactly what I mean. I think it's very difficult. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I think it's very difficult in the world that we find ourselves in to truly, completely decolonize, because I have no lived memory of what life was like before colonization. Mm. The surname that I have is not the surname that my family was given.
Yeah.
You know, I'm still having to fight for the idea of being Black British, as opposed to having some additional either Caribbean or African appended to it. And even within that, mm-hmm. whereabouts in the Caribbean were my family from, in inverted commas, and therefore whereabouts in West Africa, more than likely, were they taken from? Mm-hmm. So to completely decolonize, I think for me personally, would be almost impossible, because my thought process is predicated on a colonized thought process. It's predicated within a colonized language. We're speaking it now. I don't know what my, in inverted commas, native language would be. Hmm. I think there's a really interesting thing about thinking about roots, thinking about lineage, more so than history. And I think part of the problem with colonization is, where do you append your roots? Where do you decide that you started? And that, in a way, is kind of freeing.
But like you say, Dermot, it's also predetermined for you, because much like the African community, the Indian community have been colonised for over 400 years. The British have been there for a long time. So even our roots within our motherland are determined through the lens of colonisation. Generations go back, let alone the modern history that's pervaded out of it. So I think there's something really interesting in how we understand the kind of how history has played out, how modern power structures have held on. And especially where we are right now, where actually the very clear divide and rule tactic used by the British in the late 1800s, in the late 1900s, oh my goodness, in 2024, are still going strong. And they were these kind of systems of appropriation of power are still being used today. So I think if I think of South Asian cultures, I wasn't born in India. I didn't learn my mother tongue. I was born in Kenya. I'm Kenyan Indian. Then I came here. So kind of far away from my land, from my home. And if I try and look back at two generations of my family, three, I still can't answer the questions. Four, five, six, I don't know.
It's interesting, because the thing about generations, I mean, I can't trace my family tree back more than four. Because something happened across the Atlantic.
Have you tried then, Dermot? You tried to do that?
Yeah, I remember when I was 11 years old, very clearly, 10 or 11, I was in year 6 at primary school, and we did this whole thing about family trees. And there was one person in my class, who could trace their family back to 1066.
Wild.
bear in mind, like, I'm talking, this is pre-Google, because I'm old, right? Just let's remember this. This is like when people had pens and paper and actually spoke to each other. Do you remember that? But we did, and you know, this person in my class did this through kind of family records and kind of talking to older members of the family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we did exactly the same, and I could only get back to my father's side, I could get back to my father's granddad, so my great-grandfather, is that right? And on my mum's side, I can only do two generations before my mum. Wow. And that's where the folk memory stopped. And I've since tried to find that stuff. And it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. I always find it really interesting that on the BBC programme, Who Do You Think You Are? You know, the one where they follow family trees.
I know the one. I love
very,
it.
Very, very rarely do they have someone whose parents are both African or Caribbean or of a darker skin. Mm-hmm. Because even they know they'll get back to, if they're lucky, the 1700s, and it will splinter, and it, one side will disappear. There have been a couple of people who have had one white parent and one black parent, and funnily enough, they've followed the white parents' lineage and not so much the black parents' lineage. And again, this idea of decolonisation, that stuff is in plain sight, but we don't talk about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like you say, how many of our names have changed over time? How many are the birth dates and passports to get over? You know.
Yeah, actually, funny story that, because my granddad came over here. So my surname's Batu, right? But actually, we're Vatus. So it's V-A-T-U, and he wrote it down on the papers, and the lady typewrote it out as B-U-T-T-O-O. And then it's changed. So actually, anyone beyond this generation trying to, it would just stop there, because the paper, that was how it was written, and that's what carried on.
Yeah, and that language, again, the colonisation of language, wasn't checked.
Mm. Yeah.
So I wonder, within this, there's a way of seeing decolonisation or as an end point, or I suppose as a practice and as an ongoing process, and something that we work at doing. And do both of you feel like you have a way of approaching it? What is your trying or working?
Well, it's a really hard question. I think I'm a lot of it comes out of being quite mindful. I realise I check myself a lot, instead of checking everything around me and going, that's wrong, or that's wrong, or that's right. You know, I grew up as a South Asian woman in Kenya. My parents were born in Kenya. But there was the race construct was very prevalent there from the British as well, and through the colonial lens, because, you know, the racism amongst the South Asian community, I saw that in play, because there was a hierarchy of society. So how the South Asians viewed the indigenous people of that country had a power construct to it, had a hierarchy to it. And this kind of conditioning becomes ingrained. The systems are built to support a certain attitude. So I think in terms of decolonization, a lot of it is about how I'm kind of responding and reacting to those systems around me, and how I work within them. But in terms of a practice, I mean, I guess as a storyteller, I want to tell the stories that have been erased, because that is my history. I want to, if we don't understand our colonial history, for good and for bad, and I say that as a British Asian, how on earth do we understand what's happening right now? And we are in 2024 with a horrendous genocide that will not stop, you know, and let alone what's happening in Gaza. We've got a world that is breaking at the seams, and people don't understand why. And warfare comes from the history of power and colonialism. And it's not about trauma storytelling. It is about embracing our lived experience and knowing that we have agency and validity within that experience.
I couldn't agree more. I really couldn't agree more. Although, I say that, I think the idea of erasure of stories is an interesting semantic. I think I have an issue with the word erasure, and this is not me kind of pointing at you, but you hear people talking about they're erasing our history or rewriting history.
Yeah.
It is impossible to erase something that has existed, because there will always be a trace of it. If we think in terms of scientists haven't seen a black hole, but they've seen the things that happen around what they assume to be a black hole, and therefore that's what it is. They're looking at the effects of, as opposed to the thing itself. You know, in the same way, whenever there's an eclipse, we're told to make those paper shadow things so we don't actually look directly at the sun, because that will burn our retinas. I'm sure there's a metaphor in there, but I'm not going to delve into it. But the idea of kind of erasing stories, I think it's about uncovering. I think there's something about removal of, or hiding of, or ignorance of, and ignorance in both stupidity and ignoring. And I think finding those stories, because they exist, because they have been written down. Yeah. And if they haven't been written down, then they have been told, and they've been passed through generations. There's oral histories, which often aren't as well held. And it's finding those histories. It's thinking about where they came from. It's going, actually, I know this, but why do I know this? I don't know where it goes beyond there. Okay, so instead of looking for the point of light, let me look at the shadows that that light will have created and then piece things together that way. It's about thinking about lineage. It's, you know, I keep going back to this idea of a tree. If we don't think about how deep the roots of the tree are, then the tree itself can't stand.
Exactly.
So I think decolonization is, you could argue, it's about looking at where the roots are.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
And dismantling, it was the other part of the question, right?
Yeah.
I worry about the term dismantle. Again, I'm being semantic, but I worry about the term dismantle because if you dismantle something, you need to put something else in its place. And I think, again, I'm going to be a pedant for words today. You've caught me on a word pedantry day, apparently. But the idea of revolution is dangerous. Because what is a revolution? You start at zero, you do 360, and you come back to where you started. Mm-hmm. I think we should be thinking about evolution. And if we, instead of thinking it as a circle, we should think of it as an upward helix, an upward spiral. Yeah. So we are turning, but we're moving away from the point that we started.
I suppose I would think of, like, with that, I often think of, like, dismantle and repair often go, like, hand in hand, like, or, like, build, not maybe not repair. If I don't want to get into Dermot's bad books with words today.
It's Semantic Thursday.
Yeah. or whichever day you're listening to this on.
Yes. Yeah.
But I think of, like, if you dismantle a structure or whatever, you have to build something in its wake at the same time. I personally think, like, it's impossible to take something back to nothing and then build from scratch. It's not impossible, but it's like the generative process is often more exactly that, generative than just like wiping out. But I know that everyone has very different approaches to this.
Well, I think even, I love how you put that, Diamond, even in terms of revolution and evolution, just taking those two words, in terms of that generative process, gives us two different feelings, you know. And I think there's something, if we had an attitude of evolution within our concepts of change, no matter where we sat, wherever we sat on that decision-making spectrum, I think we'd be in a much healthier place than we currently are in our sector anyway. Mm. I think revolution right now is also a zeitgeist, this kind of sense of polarisation we are in, where everybody has to have an opinion, which either, if they're right, you have to put everyone else down who isn't on your side and garner the support from everyone who is, which feels like it shuts down conversation. It's an echo chamber. So for me at the moment, that's how people are taking revolution, which doesn't feel so progressive at all. It feels quite the opposite. Mm. So I think in terms of dismantling, or it's about rebuilding, I think, rethinking, having a kind of being brave. I mean, I was speaking to Nancy Medina and the term safe space came up. And just went, oh, God, I hate that word. And she went, no, it's not safe space. It's brave space.
Brave, yeah.
Oh, I love that.
And I love that. Mm. And actually, that's what we have to keep bringing to the table every day with love.
I was going to say that I'm interested to know from you both, because actually Beth and I are still freelancing, that actually is not empowering. We are freelancing, and you guys are leading and have led organisations. And I'm just really interested to know from your perspectives and from yours as well, Beth, about when we're talking about decolonising, dismantling this industry, how empowered do you feel to do that in the roles that you're in and that you've had within structures, with boards, etc., like with the current structures that exist in your organisation or in the past organisations that you've worked for? And then also, like, how do we move forward together, whether you're in a position of power or not, to start to make real change?
Well, moving forward together, collective action. And I know, again, I've put two words out there, it can be generally, but we need to come together collectively and actually make a stand for something. We're very bad at doing that as a sector. We can't do it for how badly our funds are disseminated. We can't do it against the injustices of war. Do you know? So I think if we don't know how to stand up for what the value of art really is as a sector, I don't know how the rest of it moves forward quickly. There's some very basic things we need to sort out about what art is for and why we're here. Mm-hmm. The thing that's inspired me as a leader and a leader who's a woman and a woman of colour is that there are a lot more of us at these decision-making tables. So that inspires me, because we can make change, because we can collaborate, we can work together, we can build something, much like we are doing right now.
I think theatre making in and of itself is a collaborative process. Mm-hmm. There's an old African proverb, and I really wish I could find the citation. If someone can, please email whoever you can and let me know where this comes from. And if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
Mm.
And there's a reason why I'm over the moon that For Black Boys and Red Pitch are doing what they're doing in the West End, because it's showing that if we go together, we can go far. And what the industry tends to do is pit us against each other.
Yes.
You're both going for that pot of money. You're both going for that directing role. You've not got it, therefore you must hate the person. No, actually, I'm glad that person's got it.
Correct, yeah.
Because that person is going to lift all of us up. Sometimes it is right to applaud as opposed to be applauded.
Mm-hmm. What's fascinating is all of what you're talking about is linking back so wonderfully to this idea of decolonizing the mind. Mm-hmm. And what you're all touching on is that these structures exist, but we have a choice of how we navigate our ways through them. But also these structures are upheld because of mindsets and because of attitudes. And so the decolonizing the mind is like that first step, which feels so important, and kind of like how do we empower and equip our industry to do that or start
doing
that?
Well, we need more people of colour on boards, in buildings, behind the scenes, on the stage. We need more people of colour everywhere. And we still, it's a minimal number. We're still, you know, part of a quota. We're still a percentage. No, we need to be ever-present, ubiquitous, much like our white peers and counterparts, much like our white peers. Because if we're not, we are only we're kind of like the sequin on the bag. We're not the bag. With a little adage.
Bit, right?
Yeah, we're always the best bit. But, you know, we have to be integrated and intersectional in our thinking.
With all of that in mind, because actually it's just made me think about, I went to go and see, is it My White Best Friend? Did you guys catch that?
Rachel Delahaye's thing.
Yeah, saw it at the Royal Exchange a couple of years ago now, and I feel bad because I can't credit the writer properly, but I will find and credit them. It was a South Asian man, I think, who wrote it, and he was talking about the amount of space that all of this race, decolonize it, identity takes up in his brain. His provocation to the audience was like, imagine, or to his best friend, his white best friend, was imagine where I could be if that didn't take up so much of my brain. Imagine how much more I could have created. Imagine what I could have invented. Because I have to deal with that on a daily basis. And it completely blew my mind. I was in tears because I was like, God, that's so true. Like, how much of our mind is taken up with that every single day? And this leads us on to my next question, which is about, do global majority artists have spaces to dream? So actually, I've used that safe space word, but the space thing. But it's like, it's probably two-pronged, right? Because it's, do global majority artists have the space to dream, and all the time, the capacity.
Yeah.
Can I again be a pedant?
Please.
I think the question is not, do global majority artists have spaces to dream? Because yes, who says they haven't?
Mm.
I think the question is, should we... I think the question should be, can we have spaces to dream freely and without qualification? So I don't want to have to sit and pitch a play or have a play pitched to me. Not that I've got any position of power. But I don't want to have to sit and listen to pitches where people are saying, but you should put this on because it fits in with this and this and this and this and this, which are the things that people outside of them have decided make that piece of work good. What I want to be able to talk about work and kind of go, it is this because that's what it is. I don't want to have to qualify that it will bring in, you know, that person, those people from that sector, and it will bring in that amount of audience from that, and it can do that for your outreach department, it can do that for your education department. I don't want to have to worry about that.
Mm.
I want to be able to make work. A really good mate of mine, Samina Hussain, extraordinary director. Oh,
brilliant woman all around, yeah.
Yeah. She said, so, and she'll kill me if I get this wrong, but she said she'll know that we've made it when she can make a play about a pink elephant and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And in that, there's a level of, as a non-white maker of theatre, how often are we expected to talk about the colour of our skin? Yeah. How often are we expected to talk about... you know, our religious practices, our cultural practices, the food that we enjoy.
Mm.
How often are we expected to defend the indefensible or defend things that have nothing to do with us? How often do we... I mean, I'm genuinely fed up of, and it's still happening, of the Asian community leader or the Black community leader. Yeah, because we're all bloody homogenous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Come off it. Because if we're going to do that, then when are we going to get the white community leader who's going to explain to us why my mortgage is going up every month, why I can't afford to put petrol in my car? Because that's from the white community, because they're all in... They, again, I'm being homogenising, but that's what it feels like. And also that thing about hierarchy. I think the idea about having spaces to dream is... Yes, I think we do have spaces to dream. I think... Some of it comes down to, and I find this myself, of kind of, when do I get the time to just stop and think about nothing? And often I don't. And I don't often because it's constantly working.
Yeah.
But also, I also think, I wonder whether or not, and this comes back to an earlier question, I wonder whether or not the reason why... I try and do what I do is because I'm at a position in my, if you want to call it a career, or my life, whereby, not that I don't care, because I do deeply, but I recognise that I have a level of privilege that I didn't have 20 years ago. And I talk to people who are 20, 25 years younger than me, who I want them to realise that for Black Boys and Red Pitch, we're not always in the West End. And you're living in a time where that is actually happening. And for that to continue, you have to recognise, not that it's special, but you need to recognise that it is possible. And that it should be possible. And that we shouldn't have to fight so hard to get to where we are. And I say all of this, you know, and there are loads of people we could mention, but I say all of this with thinking about people like Mona Hammond, thinking about people like Norman Beaton, thinking about people like my dear friend Joe Melville, thinking about allies, thinking about Maury Melvin, thinking about Phil Headley, who we've recently lost. All of these people, we stand on their shoulders. And if we don't continue to say, actually, what they've gone through, the bits of the mountain that they've climbed and then passed on to us, if we don't look down and go, that's where we've come from, but that's where we're going to, then we're letting them down. And when you get to a place of privilege, when you get to a place of ability, when you get to a place of, actually, some people might actually listen to you, if you're not speaking up for those people who haven't found their voices yet, they will never find their voice. And I think part of what's stopping people getting to that place is fear. It's fear of changing things. It's fear of rocking boats. But we're at a position where we can rock boats. So let's do that, and let's do it mindfully and with love and with dedication and with heart and with bravery, not safety. Safety keeps you where you are. Bravery takes you somewhere else.
Yeah.
No, I agree with that. And I...
Sorry. I agree with that. But I also just to kind of play a little bit of devil's advocate, like, it's so brilliant that Red Pitch and For Black Boys is on at the West End. And for our peers, how brilliant. And it should be. It's long overdue. We still don't see it enough. So when we talk about safety and programming for Black Boys and Red Pitch, it's the determination of those shows actually getting on the West End lies somewhere that also needs to be refreshed and remodeled and re-looked at in terms of how we view global forms of storytelling, if you like. We don't see enough from the West End from global majority artists or from the global majority lens, which is why, you know, shows like we're mentioning, being on the West End is so extraordinary, and long may it continue. There are shows that have obviously started, had a following of an audience, had a dynamic response that you go, of course, we build it, they will come. I guess what I'm saying is, having one show on here or two shows on at the same time and then not seeing anything for another 8 months, 10 months, 2 years, 5 years, that's where we get into a problem. We don't know the shoulders we're standing on. Does that make sense?
It makes a huge amount of sense, and I don't think we disagree at all. I think I absolutely agree with you. I think what I probably haven't made clear is, with those two shows, we're taking those two shows as an exemplar of what we're saying, but both of those shows have been in development for years. This is what, the fifth, sixth outing for Black Boys?
Yeah, they were, and they weren't developed by West End.
Oh, no.
They weren't developed for that West End.
They were cultivated with their audience through the whole process.
Yeah.
Because essentially what happened was the West End said, oh, there's money there that can be made off the back of the hard work that's already been put in.
I think that's kind of the point I'm trying to make.
I agree with you. I think what we need to be working towards, where we get Red Pitch Part 2 by a writer that we don't know, that turns up next year at Soho Place, having not played anywhere else, because that theatre, the West End, the industry, in inverted commas, has gone, this is going to be good, let's give it a go. In the same way that I've never known a David Hare play to play for 6 months, 12 months, 24 months somewhere else before it's got in somewhere. And that's not to jump on David Hare.
No, exactly. I think that's the point I was trying to make. Thank you for making it so succinctly for me.
Yeah.
That, you know, our processes, our processes and what's acceptable it still needs a lot of reviewing, I think.
Mm. Yeah, certain stories and certain perspectives are still seen as risky. Mm. Yeah.
But I think we need to be careful not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We're there now, and we've proven that it's possible. Yeah, so that's one thing that we can tick off.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't there 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And now we need to get to the point where we don't have to go through 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. And it's frustrating, but it's patience. It's baton passing.
Yeah, and it's not dropping it, right? Because if we think about the 80s and 90s when, you know, The Real McCoy, Goodness Gracious Me, were on, these shows came, there was a flurry of it. It was really exciting. And then they stopped, and they stopped hard and fast. And now we feel like we've gone backwards to where we were at that point. So I think there is something really important about holding on and moving forward, and that going back to that collective action, going forward together. But it takes us all coming to the table and go and, you know, holding hands and doing it, I guess.
Great. Okay, that leads us to our final sort of question for the table, which is about, how do we go about setting boundaries for ourselves, for our peers, but just sort of, if we're talking about moving this forward, how do we protect ourselves, basically, in not taking too much on and actually affecting ourselves physically, emotionally. So I suppose maybe it's about a thing about good practice that you do that we could learn from, some tips, some pointers.
I can tell you what you should do, but not necessarily what I do.
Yeah, well, go on then. Let's start with that. What?
So, yeah, we should drink 2 litres of water every day, and we should sleep for 8 hours. What should we do? I think, like, jokes aside, I think looking after, and I say this to students all the time, if you don't look after your health, then you're not going to be able to make anything approaching wealth. If you don't look after yourself, you can't move forward. And that's about mindfulness, right? That's about understanding that your boot is going to fly open down the M1 if you don't make sure that the car's locked. So you need to make sure... You see what I've done there? It's circular. So you need to make sure that... You need to make sure and check in with yourself.
I think that's such a big one that it gets missed a lot, is protecting your mental health, and that thing about you saying about not when you reach burnout, but when you are seeing signs of it. That's a great one. You said something about mental health and then wealth, like before you check your wealth. And actually my pointer is to do with wealth, and it's something that I talked to Beth a lot about, which is about talking about money. I'm a big believer in, especially between freelancers, making sure that you're talking a lot about what your peers are getting paid, how much you're getting paid for productions, what your day rate is, and just making sure that if you're in a place where you cannot accept a job because it doesn't pay you enough, because you won't be able to survive that month, do not take it, because somewhere else will pay better. And I think it's about the confidence in that. It's the privilege of being able to do that at a certain point in your career. But I think Absolutely. The more we talk about it as artists, the more demystic. I think it's quite a British thing not to talk about money. Like, my family talks about bloody money all the time. It's like, how much are you earning? What are you earning? What are you earning? And I think if we do a little bit more of that, there may be less disparity between what we're all getting paid, and that whole thing about playing each other off. Oh, I'll get one black or brown artist for this day rate. Well, I can get one for cheaper. And I think, I'm hammering on, but I think, yeah, talking about money is actually my tip about setting boundaries and, yeah.
And sharing that knowledge.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Have you got one, Beth?
Time. Rehearsal. This is something, like, yeah, I know we were speaking about money earlier, but as a director, we're in a certain position of privilege within a rehearsal process where you can set what time rehearsals start and finish. It's really, really simple one, but I do think that, like, shorter days benefit everybody. And that boundary of going, no, I'm not going to do 10 to 6 rehearsals and then go into meetings in lunchtime and then other meetings in the evening or whatever, like, I will work, I will do 10 to 6 full stop, if you say it up front at the beginning. And try and make that, again, that slow change, if you can keep sort of trying to make that slow change within different institutions or organisations that you work for, hopefully the ripples will happen.
You got one, Pooja?
It's a difficult one, but I think for me, the thing that's kept me steadfast, I mean, I think I have to constantly redraw my boundaries, because I grow and I change and I keep learning. But the one thing that I guess I can say this in retrospect, is my integrity. Whatever that, and that in itself evolves as I grow older, but there is something I know about myself and where my best self sits, I guess. And for me, holding on to that and being driven by that has been really important for me. Why am I here doing this work? Why is it important that doors are open and artists are developed and have agency? Every show that I do as well, that I kind of lean into that space in myself and try and really come from there. And when things go tits up, that's where I hold on to, I guess.
I think that draws us to the end of our episode. That was such a juicy conversation, and I just really wish we had more time to delve into that. We could probably talk, like, about those topics for a day. Thank you so much once again, Dermot and Pooja. You've been incredible first guests for our first episode for this series. So thank you so much again, and we will catch you guys on the next episode.
Thank you for listening.
Bye. If you love this episode, then please do share it with your friends and maybe even leave a cheeky review.
And for more of Tell Them, don't forget to subscribe and follow us on our socials for episode drops. Next week, we'll be chatting with Izzy Raby and Vinay Patel.